the first thousand of them, and they're all brilliant. And this one, it seems particularly potent. Of course, there's no order of difficulty in miracles, as we all know. So I just thought it would, this is one of these listener discretion advised ones, because it not because it's the form is squeamish for any of us, but I think because the content in our minds, that this particular example and the particularly the response that's provided gets into. So can you hear me now, Lynn? Can you hear me, Lynn? I think I hear you. Hello. Well, I will just proceed with the assumption that I'm being heard. Let me see if I, while I'm talking, see if I can log into Pal Talk and at least hear what's going on, and see if my audio is getting through. I'll at least get an echo for a second there, right? I'll go to the listening live and let's see if I hear myself. Okay. Oh, good. Okay. There we go. Okay, I'm hearing an echo, which is now several seconds delayed. So I'm gonna say an apology to all the listeners that my audio is getting through. So I'm not hearing Lynn yet, but again, thank you and apologies for the technical issues. Lynn's doing her utmost to try to get things sorted out on her end, but she's managed, I think, to patch me through in terms of my audio, which has been problematic over the last couple of years. Another forgiveness opportunity. So anyway, good morning all. I'll pretend like I'm starting again and almost 10 minutes into the hour here. What I thought would be interesting to do is read frequently asked question number 1006 from the FACIM outreach.org website, which is basically one of the gold mines, in my opinion, of inspiration and brilliant commentary on A Course in Miracles, as part of the FACIM.org website. It's actually got its own domain, which is FACIMOutreach.org, and there's about 1,300 some odd questions. I just passed the 1,000 mark the other day, and going through them sequentially, having skimmed them a bit over the years, knowing that there's great stuff there, and finally thinking, gee, I think I could probably get a lot out of reading these just one at a time. And I know I'm going to go back through them again, because we all tend to, I believe, get these insights when there's really clear, undiluted information that comes from that awareness, regardless of the source. I think what happens is we acknowledge it on some level, and then we, in our saner moments, we nod and say, yeah, that's right. And then as quickly as we nod, more often than not, it seems like it appears to go in one ear and out the other. But I think it then starts the process. So that's my hope here, is that for myself and anyone who's listening, that we can take this sort of information and let it simmer, maybe on the back burner as it meets with our resistance. But then if we can learn to forgive ourselves more and more and for the resistance and for wanting to judge ourselves for the resistance and not forgiving ourselves for the resistance, all that whole gamut of stuff, I think it can be really helpful. So I'm just going to start reading this question and see if it rings true for you as far as, again, the form is very specific in terms of a woman talking about her children and in vitro fertilization and miscarriages. But I think the if we can extrapolate or extend and generalize the essence of this question to what we're all doing all the time, believing that we're here in this world and making that a big deal, I think we can use that to good effect. So, now I'll finally actually just read the question, which is number 1006. I've read. Hey, I can hear you, Lynn.
Yeah, well, yeah. I tried to mute myself and run at the same time I coughed, but
that's okay.
So he said, "Yay!"
Okay, so
go ahead. I didn't hear anything you've just said, so I can continue to read.
Okay. So, what I was just sharing, and again, additional apologies to people who have been listening for our technical issues, and thank you, Lynn, for all that you're doing, because I know it's a juggling act, and you do this a lot too, not just on Saturday mornings when I get on, but anyway, so kudos and great gratitude to you and so many others that I know are on this forum and sharing tremendous stuff. So anyway, thank you for all that you do and to everyone else for all that you do and all the listeners for you know, your attention and interest and all. Because it's all helping. It's all part of that process of undoing the ego, which we're all helping each other with together, aren't we? So here's FAQ number 1006, which I think is just, again, one example of this gold mine of really wonderful, insightful information. I'm just going to read this question 1006, and it starts out, "I have read your answer to question number 15, yet somehow I need a little more help. I have a healthy son I'm thrilled with, whom I had through in vitro fertilization. I desired more children, but since have lost two to miscarriages. I believe I have a great deal of guilt in that my age, past 40, would be a gamble, and here seemed the proof, death of both embryos due to chromosome damage. I really feel like I murdered them both by seeking magic, the in vitro fertilization. So here's my issue. Almost daily, when I'm with my son, someone asks if he is my, quote, only child, unquote. My mind instantly swings into guilt mode. I know the question is just a conversation opener, but it feels like an attack. I have issues around the miscarriages, older stepchildren, and adopting, and all my feelings bubble up. The last time I could only nod my head in shame and guilt. With my 5-year-old son there, and unaware of all the details, I could not attack back as my ego wants. Quote, no, he is not my only, the other two are dead! Exclamation point, unquote. And I realize an attack would alienate everyone. But my internal buttons of feeling, internal buttons and feelings of sin, guilt, and fear are being pushed. I am still stumped as to how to cope with all this. I do acknowledge what is happening in the moment and how enraged I become. I do see how they're bringing up this deep pain, which is just scratching the surface of the original pain of killing God, makes me want to, quote, kill, unquote, through words or fantasy, the person I perceive as my attacker, even though they only have unintentionally handed me the mirror so I can look at my guilt. I also know intellectually that I did not murder my unborn children, but part of me must not believe it. I ask for help from Jesus and show him my negative thoughts, but I would like more healing than this. I find it difficult to accept the statement, loss is not loss when properly perceived. I understand intellectually that this is all an illusion, that I'm not a body. But when this stuff comes up, they are just concepts to my ego." So there's the question posed, number 1006, if you want to read along from the FACIMOutreach.org website. And again, you can get to that from FACIM.org. Do you have any comments so far, Lynn, before I
read? I'm just saying that this is an interesting question that has so many levels of
confusion. Yes.
There's so many things to get confused about in this kind of situation. And
and
you don't tease out and look at every single bit of it. You could just say, oh, well, you know, I'm just feeling bad because I feel separate from God. But, I mean, there's so many nuances in this. So I'm interested to hear how they answer the question.
Total level of confusion. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and apologies for talking over. Sometimes the delay, I think, exacerbates that talking over each other aspect. But anyway, very much a loaded question. And I, as you're saying that, I was thinking, wow, the holidays bring, typically for most people, brings up so many things around specialness and expectations and, you know, a lot of rich stuff. So I don't think people have to usually go too far, particularly this time of year, but certainly throughout the year, the more we pay attention and start developing a habit of watching our minds. at, you know, all the different levels and all the different aspects of something a question like this can bring up. So without further ado, I will start reading the answer. And why don't I read a paragraph at a time, and then we can talk about it. How's that sound? Because I think there's a lot here. Or maybe
I think so, too. That's great. That would be a wonderful thing. Yeah.
Okay. So the answer starts out, where you are with your feelings is okay. You don't want to try to use the intellectual concepts of A Course in Miracles to change what seems to be happening for you. You will know at a deeper level that they are true at some point on your spiritual path. But for now, you simply want to be as honest as you can about your thoughts and feelings about your life circumstances. They, after all, comprise your classroom. Mostly you speak of your guilt, but what also comes through very clearly is your anger. And although you acknowledge your rage at the stranger's inquiries, there almost certainly are layers to that anger. There's the word layers. Thank you, Glenn. To that anger that you may be missing by jumping to the ontological explanation that you killed God. I'm raising my hand in virtual space here because I think I do that too sometimes. I think we probably all do. We just use a metaphysical platitude, right? And all these unrecognized and unacknowledged layers of defenses continue to operate below your awareness, keeping your focus outside yourself, which of course is their purpose, despite your best intentions to look at the guilt within. So there's the first of four paragraphs. So like you say, Lynn, there's a lot there, huh? Any comments so far?
No, I totally agree, and that was my thought exactly. So continue on.
Okay. So the second paragraph continues in the answer to FAQ number 1006, just for people who have just joined us. What might these other layers involve? Your anger at the strangers seems somehow out of proportion to the nature of their, quote, attack, unquote, as you acknowledge. It may feel safer to keep the focus of your anger on them rather than other, perhaps less conscious targets. For it seems likely from what you say that you are angry that you have not been able to have the children you want. Perhaps angry at a spouse or ex-spouse, a lover, a parent, or God. That covers a lot of turf there, doesn't it? and of course, anybody else in our lives. Right? That's my aside there. Someone else who is somehow responsible for depriving you of what you so desperately want, requiring you to rely on your own creative attempts to have the children on your own that will make your life feel more complete. And there must also be great sadness and grief at the recurring losses. It's important that you uncover the anger and grief you are carrying and all the hidden justifications for those feelings, not because they're true, but because you still believe at some level that they are true. And you cannot jump to the ontological explanation without looking at the ego's layers of defenses as clearly as you can, or you will simply keep the defenses unexamined and intact. And it refers to Chapter 11, Section 5, Paragraph 1 and 2 in the text. So, again, there's a lot of material there. And again, it seems like our anger and grief and guilt and all those what we call negative emotions are, oftentimes buried, and we disguise them and cover them over, and we mentally go about in what sometimes is called obsessive compulsive behavior, or other times is just, you know, not necessarily a whole bunch of different labels, but the way that we jump to action, we jump to doing things, and even if we're not physically doing things, we do things with the ego as our thought system, as our inner teacher, which is always problematic by definition, basically. And, you know, whenever we jump in and try to fix the problem at the level of form, you know, we can very easily do the spiritual bypass and not look at the deeper cause. And we can also do that by thinking that we're looking at the deeper cause by saying, oh, well, it's ontological guilt, and, you know, use fancy words like ontological. I can't always keep
framework,
having,
yeah.
have to look up, you know, in the dictionary because I keep forgetting what it means. But, you know, the essence is, you know, every time I do open a physical or virtual dictionary, it's, you know, basically, you know, all encompassing, core, fundamental, essential, you know, that kind of thing. So, but that's probably not the definary, that's not the
definary diction.
The definary diction.
Like the, me, I do that all the time.
The dictionary definition.
That's too much eggnog over Christmas.
I'm not listexic. Anyway, but yeah, isn't it interesting how quickly we can, you know, jump to something that is more comfortable in our minds when we uncover these, you know, listener discretion advised topics that basically remind us that, you know, the ego's mind is this seething cauldron of crap that doesn't exist, but we don't know it doesn't exist until we look at it. And that's what I think this question is jumping right at the heart of and helping us look at gently, so that we don't jump to the finish line where we can't really get except in, you know, a nice ideal way in our mind, but it doesn't seem real to us unless we go through the process of forgiving ourselves for the specifics. And we don't have, like the Course says, we don't have to dredge it up. It's just, it's there. All we have to do is just, you know, just take our fingertip and, you know, lick our pinky finger and skim down with one little swipe at the thin veneer of.
You have a streak left.
Really, but it's like it's thinner than tissue paper, you know. But it seems like this impenetrable, you know, Gibraltar or Half Dome or El Capitan wall, you know. Of it's my screen background, so that's it's handy. Of you know, this solid rock that we can't get through, you know, this huge obstacle. But it's thinner than the thinnest. Gold leaf veneer or actually, you know, tarnished, ego's tarnished, material, whatever its gold substitute would be. Cause it's fool's gold. But there's nothing there. We just have to look at it with the Holy Spirit. Okay. Let me go on. But I think if you, you know, follow the drift here, there's just so much to look at and, we don't have to do it all at once is another, I think, important thing, but just gently, patiently, without condemning ourselves, and bring all of our condemnations of ourselves and each other onto the altar of the mind. So let me continue with the third paragraph. Once you can get in touch with the anger and the specific thoughts behind that anger, you can begin to take responsibility for the projection involved in those just judgments against others. Now, it is true that all the levels of anger are simply defenses against the underlying ontological guilt. But the thought that we believe we have killed God is mostly an intellectual concept for most of us, which is, as Jesus tells us, quote, an instance so ancient that is beyond all memory and past even the possibility of remembering. And that's from section 2 in the manual. But we relive its content every instant that we choose the ego, putting our own needs and desires above everyone else's. Now there's a gold mine of but also a gold mine in terms of a memory jog and a mindfulness exercise that if we can notice whenever we're, you know, slumming in our mind in separate interests instead of shared interests, whenever it's my benefit over someone else's, you know, at the expense of someone else, that should be, you know, a massive red light, you know, stop the press, you know, pull the cord on the trolley car, you know, get off the.
Someone's being asked to sacrifice. There's,
yeah.
And it's so funny. Something that I just said a moment ago that just hit me too. You were talking about it's thinner than the thinnest, leaf of gold. And that's called guilt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's a good pun. I love it. That's great. Thank you, Vanilla. Yes. Yeah, it's not just gilded, it's guilt. that's a form of the word that I don't hear too often, but it's, isn't that funny how our language We cover over with a luster, you know, and we lust after.
I know.
The dream that we think is going to make us happy, but in order to disguise that, sometimes we projection takes both the special love and special hate varieties, and so, you know, sometimes it's the special loves that, you know, we glamorize and rhapsodize and make big deals out of in a way that still makes happiness out of reach, because we haven't achieved the woman talking about wanting the children that she didn't get because of biological reasons. And again, you know, like Ken says, there is no biology. There's no bi. how could there be, again, Wapnick, of course, how could there be a biology if there's no body, if there's no world? The central thought the Course attempts to teach. But we have to, look at all the things that this are the specifics, rather than jumping over and doing the spiritual bypass, jumping over the steps and going straight to the, we never killed God explanation. That can be a way of conveniently avoiding looking at the specifics that are up for us in our lives. And I can think of, plenty just over the last few days of thinking about, my Christmas, for example, was very different than most over the last few decades, actually, and it's tempting to look at my change in circumstances and go into either a martyrdom or a pity or a regret or just even a wistful kind of thing, like, oh, if it could only be like some of those past ones, or all of that stuff comes up. I mean, if you just watch your mind, and even if you think you're having a good time, just look at the subtle, Or sometimes not so subtle, off the wall, meltdowns that ego has, I like to call it tantrum yoga, in all of its, major and minor forms, and just see how that's a constant attempt to keep us from being mindful and to keep us mindless, huh?
Absolutely. And it's so insidious. See, this is what people don't understand, which I didn't understand for a long time. And I just thought it was just so simple. Oh, I practice forgiveness. What a trip that is, to be thinking that practicing forgiveness, is going to change anything, when I really didn't know and still really don't how to practice forgiveness, what it is that I'm really doing when I'm practicing forgiveness, which, as you say, it really is just looking at, teasing out every single thought and looking at its origin and looking at its reality. And, I mean, forgiveness is really an analytical thing. It has nothing to do with, I'm so grateful and loving to you that I'm going to forgive you because you, forgot my birthday when I was in second grade or whatever. It has nothing to do with that. It has to do with actually looking at what we perceive, what I perceive, and questioning the reality of it based on a knowing that I have, that reality has certain qualities, and looking at this thing that appears to be happening, recognizing, does it have the quality of reality or not? And if it has the quality of reality, then it's something that I can, listen, learn, love, grow from. If it has the quality of unreality, it's something I can forgive. I can look at it, recognize that it never has been, never could be the way that it appears to me, that it has nothing to do with reality as God made it, and therefore I can let it go. And so, but it has to be about every single bit of every single experience, I can't just cherry pick which experience I want to forgive and which experience I want to hold on to. I have to really look and recognize that, as Mr. Nisargadatta says right here on my desktop, I have a little picture of him, and it's, he says, I'm not interested to know what you've let go of. I'm interested to know what you're still hanging on to.
That's a great one. Yeah, exactly.
And the Holy Spirit, he's not interested in what we've let go of, but he's really interested, what am I holding on to? And every single thing that I'm holding on to, these concepts that this person is talking about, it applies to every, it doesn't matter what it is. If I'm feeling guilty about something, it's because I've given it all these meanings. And so I have to just look at the meanings, tease out what is real and what is not, and let go of what's not.
Yeah. And the teasing out, actually, I think is really even simpler than we make it out to be, because it's not like we have to, you know, take a pair of tweezers or a crowbar or, you know, a shovel, or it doesn't require anything other than simply getting the heck out of the way and getting our fake identity, which is the unreal, which is to say anything that could possibly change can't possibly be real. That's always been such a helpful definition to me, is this, for if it's subject to change, subject to variability, it involves differences or separation, or and there's an acronym I came across that I also find helpful: guilt, individuality, space and time. It's actually kind of like guilt, but it's just the GILT that we were talking about earlier, GIST. Guilt, individuality, space, and time. If any of those things are involved, I figure, well, there's my block. This, and it takes some specific form. My block against an experience of reality. In those moments, if I'm indulging in guilt or anger or making it my identity around the grieving about a specific that I wanted to be a certain way, and this particular FAQ question and answer dives into very nicely. If I'm using that to reinforce the problem, which is taking it seriously by not looking at it, then I'm missing that opportunity. But I'll get another one. I mean, that's a given, because we're already home. But we're just delaying. We're just simply postponing the peace that's possible. And every moment that we actually do brush aside that little thin veneer by looking at the guilt, pun intended, the golden clad, but it's the ego's tarnished version of not the real gold. It's the fool's gold again, of the luster of something that promises to make us happy outside ourselves, but if we can look at that and not be too squeamish and go past the listener viewer discretion advised warning that the ego puts up and say, okay, I'm going through this, and take the invisible scissors and cut through the police line do not cross tape and just look at the scene of the crime in the mind. We see there's nothing there. But we only do that if we take the specifics and in this case, this woman, look at the shame and the anger about others bringing up, her feelings about, wanting the children she didn't get because of, biological reasons and thinking that, we killed God, which is really the ontological thing. But we have to look at the specifics. I have to look at, why I may have not been absolutely as peaceful as I could have been yesterday or the last few weeks or the last 20 years or 50 plus or 70 plus or whatever age we think we might be. If we can look at the things that come up moment to moment, we don't need a steam shovel or a D9 caterpillar to exhume and excavate the mind's unconscious stuff. We just have to look moment to moment at what's in front of our face, huh?
That's it. And we are not bereft of any opportunity.
Yes. No, we've got plenty, don't we? And, exactly. And it takes that honesty to see that every moment really is an opportunity, seen properly, to look at our investment in an unreal, dysfunctional identity that hasn't served us and never will.
Yeah. And boy, that's my focus. I think I've really been brought front to center with my own responsibility for what it is that I'm seeing. And, recognizing that it's the same thing that I've been seeing, just in a different version over and over and over and over and over and over and over.
Could you say that again, Lynn, a few more times?
Groundhog Day from day one.
I love that movie.
It's like, Flight into Terror is, really it is a whole, experience of loss and disappointment and fear and of course there are the little joys that make everything seem okay for a moment, but even
special
those
loves.
Yeah, the special love, and even those are so filled with the nostalgia of what is going to happen when, this, beautiful puppy that I just bought, who was so sweet and cute in, 14 years is going to be dead. I'm already grieving over, a future loss. There is not a single thing that comes to me that doesn't entail, even if it's a great thing, a future loss, many future losses, many, many future losses, as long as I believe in it and I base my understanding or knowing about what I am and what the world is on that particular thing being okay. And if it's not okay, then everything goes to hell. And doesn't matter what it is, I'm depending on something that is not dependable. And I'm basing my life on something that is baseless. Mm-hmm. All those things, it's intellectually, it's easy to, see that that's true. But to know it and just to feel in yourself that feeling of that knowing that loss is inevitable, death is inevitable, all these things are just going to keep coming back and coming back until we absolutely heal the cause of it. And the cause of it cannot be healed by putting band-aids on the effect. The cause can only heal by going into the actual cause of every single thing and looking at what it is and looking at the guilt that is behind all of it. So this woman's letter is all about guilt and all about, not only does she feel with guilt, but she is subconsciously, not even subconsciously, she's consciously wanting to punish other people for her situation too. And that's what we do. We punish ourselves. We punish the world. We project evil out into all places. And that is all we see when we look then.
Yep.
And it's pretty amazing. We were reading, I played a fairy tale yesterday in the room. The story, The Snow Queen from Hans Christian Andersen. And the basis of the story, I don't know if you're familiar with that story, Bruce.
Vaguely familiar. Maybe you can give a summary.
Okay. The story itself they've made movies of it, but not really the reality of the story. The story itself starts out with a demon who makes a mirror. And the mirror shows everything that looks in it. It shows its every flaw. It shows every bit of ugliness. It shows every bit of evil. All right. So, you can put the baby looking at this mirror and it will show a hideous creature, an evil monster. Every flower, it shows it wilting and with worms crawling around. Everything you shine that reflects in the mirror reflects twisted and ugly and mean and bad.
It sounds like Snow White meets Dorian Gray.
Sort of like that, yeah. So there's this mirror, and the mirror is like so excited and so happy that it's so evil, and the little demons are having such a great time going around doing this thing with the mirror, and the mirror gets so excited and laughs so hard that it breaks into billions of pieces. and the billions of pieces of mirror go out into the world. And if you get a piece of it into your eye, then everything you look at is ugly. And if it gets into your heart freezes into a lump of ice, and you have no more love or compassion. And so that's what happened, is the whole world got dusted with this shattered mirror that caused this thing to happen to people, that the world became evil and twisted, and you know, no more compassion was there. But it's a story about a little boy who got a piece of it in his eye and his heart, and a little girl who went through this great journey to try to save him from this horrible fate. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful story of innocence and love and forgiveness and all kinds of stuff. And it's really, really good. But that's what this is. It's like the evil mirror that has got put into our heart and our eyes that is reflecting everything that we see as being hideous. Mm-hmm. And so the only way to get that out is, and in the end, it's the little girl's compassion. She cries and her tears wash into his eye and wash the glass out of his eye. And then he cries and the tears go down and melt the lump of ice that is his heart. And he recognizes her and they go home. It's really, really
what
sweet.
What a great story. Yeah.
It is. It's really great. But that's what this is. You know, we're looking at the world through this evil, sad, point of view that is in itself, there's nothing wrong with it.
Right.
It's not bad in itself. It's, you know, it's okay, except for it causes us so much pain. And so if it didn't cause us so much pain, you know, we could just be here and be wallowing in this stuff forever and ever. But it causes us pain, thank God. And so we want to wake up. We want to get through this. And so we want to go through these layers and layers and layers of mistaken thought that are causing us this pain. So I'm looking at this question, and again, we're on question 1006 from the, from the Foundation for A Course in Miracles Outreach. And the story is, the woman wrote in and said, you know, I had two miscarriages. I'm just going to cut to the chase. I had two miscarriages and I blame myself for them. And I feel guilty about it. And I want to get rid of that guilt. And
she also feels angry at the people who remind her of that when they bring it up in conversation. So, it ties into your comment about projection too.
Exactly.
Yeah. Before we leave your story about the broken mirror, it's interesting. I just want to put a quick comment about that. There was actually a conversation I had with C.A. Brooks on her weekly radio show on A Course in Miracles a few weeks ago, and she was mentioning a TV show that had an episode that had the similar theme. And I think it's such a great metaphor too, because a mirror is something that reflects, and the whole idea of reflection, of course, has to do with, you know, being true to hopefully an accurate, image, but it's not the real thing. It's a reflection of something. And a broken mirror obviously can only reflect something that seems to be, you know, a part of or separate from the pieces, and partial, and it's funny how the word partial has a couple of different meanings in our language. It's, you know, we say we can be partial to something, meaning we have, you know, partial for or partial against something, which is to say, you know, a special love or a special hate, basically, or it can be partial as in the sense of incomplete. And that also ties into another, you know, word that I think is really, helpful if we look at when it comes up for me, the word purity or pure. To me, it's also another light bulb word that I can use to notice when I'm thinking something that doesn't include everyone, that's impure. because it purity means whole and complete, and not having a quality within it that's different from any other quality, which would be to leave anybody out of perfect oneness would be an impure thought. And so every time I exclude someone, I'm breaking the mirror. I'm having an impure thought. I'm shattering perfect oneness. And I love how that ties into Gary Renard's exercise of, you know, seeing all of spirit or all of perfect oneness, all of perfect innocence in everyone, rather than just in, you know, in part or in a partiality. So anyway, lots of things we can do with mnemonic devices and words, and certainly the shattered mirror is a great one. So anyway, so should we go back to paragraph 4 in the FAQ?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. And the last paragraph in this answer is, ultimately, Jesus assures us we will learn that, quote, it is not necessary to follow fear, and then in brackets, and guilt, through all the circuitous routes by which it burrows underground and hides in darkness to emerge in forms quite different from what it is. So there's the, you know, we don't need to buy a steam shovel or a, you know, earth mover. It's going to show up, you know, we don't have to look very far beneath the surface. That little thin veneer. Yet it is necessary to examine each one as long as you would retain the principle that governs all of them. And the principle, of course, is, you know, the ego's idea that separation was possible. And that reminds me of a joke that came up the other day. We were talking about school administration. And I remember hearing this years ago. And it's the quote is, It's not the school I don't like, it's just the principle of the thing, right? Yeah. Anyway, so just a bad pun.
Yeah, it's just the principle of the thing, okay.
but that's the principle of our ego school, and its classroom is really seems to be a prison, but it's only becomes a classroom when we fire the administrator and you know, restore our inner kindness teacher to its rightful role as the, you know, the head honcho of our mind. And it's such a gentle guiding hand too, that just says, just look. You don't have to condemn, you don't have to get riled up. Just watch your tendency to want to get riled up and to make big deals and to make it real, to make the circumstance, whether it's a miscarriage or an expectation around the holidays that happened or didn't happen. You know, something that you were afraid of that happened, and or something that didn't happen. And a while back you were talking about, you know, something reminded me anyway of something that I wrote in my second book in the last chapter, about expectations and where we put our reality, and this sort of aha moment that happened to me. This was about at least 6 or 7 years ago now, I guess, when my wife was being asked to do some work for a former boss, and so it made sense logistically and financially and for a lot of other reasons for her to do that, in terms of also family obligations and needs at the time. We were living in Oregon, and she was getting ready to move to California, and I remember waking up 4 or 5 in the morning. She was still asleep, and you know, the U-Haul was basically packed, and she was going to drive down. Maybe it was just a car load of stuff at the time, but anyway, she was going to drive down to California, and we ended up seeing each other about every 6 weeks back and forth. But at the time, I realized this interesting aha moment. I was already missing her, even though she was a foot or two away, asleep next to me. So that was kind of a huge aha, realizing it's not the form, it's not the what we call physicality, it's our attitudes and our thoughts about the things and the people and the circumstances that we make a big deal out of, and we make our reality. Now, that was a golden opportunity for me to look at how I was making a big deal out of something that not even wasn't really a big deal, but it's something that hadn't even happened. And even when it seemed to happen, it was another opportunity to look at, where does this person live? And, you know, and your story about the heart and what, where we live, you know, and the, you know, what lives in our heart and you know, the fragment of the broken mirror, if we think that there's, if separation is possible, and that's the image, the fake, the false image, the tarnished, the guilt, pun intended, image, that we, you know, put frames around and try to glorify, then, you know, we're basically saying that we'd rather have the illusion of connection rather than the real connection, which is only in the mind. And minds are joined and bodies aren't. but that's kind of a big aha moment for me. And
wow.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that something that you just said, many things that you just said were pretty profound, but something you just said, we would rather have the illusion than the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would rather, you know, when I, you know, just got that new puppy, you know, I'd rather be looking at my future sense of loss, knowing that, you know, he's not going to live forever. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it doesn't matter what it's my rather. I would rather think that
mm-hmm.
than to think the truth. And why is that? Because that gives me more meaning. It gives me more, you know, I have a future, and that future is going to include these things. It just proves the reality mm-hmm. of the world. It proves the reality of my circumstance. And so, I'm going to go for that because, hey, guilt says I'm real.
Yeah. That not yet that moment put yourself as a little s separate self back on the tiny throne of ego's kingdom. And, you know, it's kind of like the ego would rather be a big fish in a little pond than a little fish in a big pond. But the irony, of course, is that that's the ego's way of looking at things. In truth, we're all the one enormous fish that is the ocean. But we can't conceive of that. We can't think of a fish that's so big that it's the same size as the ocean and is the ocean. So we go for the minnow guppy, wannabe. So it's that small, you know, kingdom, thinking that that's going to do it for us, even though we're terrified of the bigger fish and we know that our little throne at the bottom of the sea in the pitch black, you know, is not really making us very happy. It's cold, it's dark, and we're under a lot of pressure with all that water over us. And a few metaphors I hadn't thought of there until I just said them. But you know, that's our little guppy minnow wannabe reality that we defend to the teeth, to the death, you know. Should we read the last paragraph? I think I started to.
Finish reading that because it's good.
The really good stuff here. Okay, I'll start it again. Ultimately, Jesus assures us we will learn that, quote, it is not necessary to follow fear and guilt through all the circuitous routes by which it burrows underground and hides in darkness to emerge in forms quite different from what it is. Yet it is necessary to examine each one as long as you would retain the principle that governs all of them. And that's from chapter 15, section 10 in the text. And that principle that we all still retain, even cling to, is that the separation and the accompanying guilt and the resulting individual self that each of us identifies with are real and require a defense. Oh, man, that little throne at the bottom of the sea, man, it's so dark. We need floodlights and swords and castles and anyway. But until we can genuinely experience the guilt at that level, we will need to begin with all the specific expressions of our guilt, usually accessed by first acknowledging our anger at others, bingo, and the judgments we are holding against them. And they're legion, aren't they? If we really look, just turn on the TV and watch your reactions to pundits and commentators and people that we think maybe are misrepresenting what we think of as the truth, just for starters. That's a really frequent one for me. Or things that we think are outrageous or unfair or mean or whatever, and or people that condemn others, and then we're, you know, then we demonize the demonizers. Anyway, just a few examples. But we have to look at the specifics, don't we? Or just, you know, people in our everyday lives. Okay, I'll go back to finishing so we can actually get this read during the time here. Over time, we will begin to recognize the common thread running through all of our projections, and the ontological guilt will become more of an experience than an empty intellectual concept. But in each case, by looking with Jesus at our projections and accepting the underlying guilt as ours, we will begin to release the need for that defense. So we just have to look at each specific, and then we begin to generalize and build the momentum as a habit of thinking and the strength of our ability to notice and notice more quickly, when we're reaching for that self-destructive thought system. And the need for anything or anyone, adult or child, to fill the emptiness we feel inside will lose its power over us. And peace and joy will then fill the space left empty by the disappearing guilt and anger. What a great paragraph, huh?
Oh, that is so beautiful. And, you know, it's Jesus promises that over and over and over and over. And until you actually experience it, you may think that this is just a, you know, it's an intellectual exercise.
Right.
But to actually experience the peace that comes from really forgiving a situation or a person or a thought, or of course it's all a thought. Every bit of it is an idea. So
exactly.
It's forgiving our own ideas, and because it's not something outside of me. It's not something, you know, it's not what you did. It's what I thought about what you did. It's not who, you know, what happened. It's what I thought about what happened. And it's my own thoughts that can be looked at and released. And when I get rid of those thoughts that are filled with pain, all that can be left is joy. You know, that's right. All that can be left when all the pain is gone is joy. And the pain is only there. This is the hard part, Bruce. This is the hard thing to know. The pain is there because I want it and I'm holding on to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
yep, we revel in the pain. Yeah. Oh, so go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say we revel in the pain, you know, that, and we savor the anguish and the grievances and all the martyrdom and victimhood. And even if we don't want to admit it, we love it because that basically says, oh, I'm real. It's just like the dysfunctional kid who's acting out that says, see me, look, I'm real. I deserve attention. I exist apart from perfect oneness. I'm this little minnow at the bottom of the ocean. Notice me.
See, I'm waving. It's the wave in the ocean, jumping up and going, hi, I'm waving. I'm here. Whoop, I'm gone. Because you can't. You can't jump out of the ocean. You can't separate yourself from your source. It's impossible. And that's the other thing. That's the good news, is that I can't change what God made. I cannot change what God made. No matter how hard I try to make myself guilty, to make myself evil, to make myself ugly, to do everything I can to try to destroy myself, I can't do anything to God's creation. I can't change it. And just to know that no matter how, what behavior I've done, no matter what I've thought, no matter what's happened to me, it never changed what I am. And it can never change what I am. I can't change what God made. So,
That's such a relief, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
that's real where our true innocence and peace lies is remembering that we haven't messed up that oneness, and it's still intact. We're good. We're good to go. We have to look at where we think we're evil, darkness, and sin, and just bring it out to the light so it can disappear. And then the little gold leaf, the tarnished copper leaf or bronze leaf or whatever, you know, the second best covering will disappear. So, well, thanks again, Lynn, and I'll post the link on this to ACIM blog later, and also hopefully I can chop off the beginning part. And anyway, thanks again. I always enjoy these conversations because it reminds me of how much you know, the, out of the default, I want to block all this stuff from my awareness and skip over steps and bypass the process. But I really can, and we all can, look at the stuff that is in the way of our perfect peace that we never left.
Exactly. So, and also I started a separate recorder. I didn't catch like the first few words that you said, but, start a separate recorder. So hopefully this is a good recording of, what did transpire this morning. So thank you again, Bruce. And thank you everyone for joining us. And we'll see you next Saturday. And, happy new year on, God bless you and your mom and your family. God bless you, Bruce. I love you.
Bye-bye. And likewise to all.
All righty. Bye-bye.